Viktor Frankl said, "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms. To choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way." This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson. Stay tuned for the next hour as Sue explores the human psyche, what makes us tick, and how to live better, more fulfilled, and more meaningful lives. Only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and today I'm with my guest who's in Australia, Linda Margolin-Royal. Welcome, Linda. You and I are seeing each other on our screens. Can you see me?
I can see you for the very first time, yeah. And it's lovely to be here. And I don't know much Afrikaans. The Afrikaans I do know, I won't share. It's probably not fit for ears.
Well, you heard about that lion that on the news now who jumped off the back of a truck. You might have to jump off the back of the truck if you use the wrong Afrikaans.
Yes, I might. I was taught at school by some new arrivals, so yeah, I won't mention.
Now, Linda is in Australia, in Sydney today, so we've got quite a few hours in between us. It's 7 o'clock your time, and I know I've got a few Australian friends and listeners listening in. So welcome to all our Australian listeners and to everyone else listening in today. Our top topic today is stand up and stand out. And Linda did a TEDx talk on this. If you'd like to pick it up, go on to YouTube for all her different talks that you can see her and hear what she has to say. And today we dedicate this program to the righteous Gentiles and the righteous people amongst us who are prepared to stand up against evil, barbarity, anti-Semitism, and hate. And Martin Luther King Jr. said, "He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetrate it." And this is very true. And today we've just heard on the news, and I'm sure, Linda, you heard as well, that the pro-Palestinian groups have been targeting our Holocaust Genocide Center, which is very much genocide center for the whole of Africa, actually, targeting our center about, you know, anti-Semitism. It really is just pure anti-Semitism. Now, Linda, you have brought out a book which is very, very fascinating, The Star on the Grave. And it's got the Star of David on the front. And I want you to tell me a bit about when you started writing this and why.
Okay, so I started writing this. My father told me the story at my son's bar mitzvah, which was 17 years ago. My late father was 80, and my brother, who was here from overseas, said, "Let's interview Dad." So we started talking to him, and I ran off and joined some of my guests, and my brother ran up to me and said, "Have you ever heard of a gentleman called Sugihara?" And I said, "No, why?" And he said, "Well, Dad just said we got transit visas to Japan from him, and that's why the family was in Japan in 1940, and he saved our lives, and he's got quite a strong memory of it." So I started interviewing him, and he gave me all the details of this hair-raising escape, and I thought, why hasn't he mentioned this? And my late grandmother, who was so full of life and love and laughter, never mentioned any trauma or anything or any escape. I knew they were in Japan, but as a teenager, I never questioned why. So I started researching and discovered that Sugihara, Chiyune Sugihara, rescued 6,000 Jews from the Holocaust with no agenda other than it was the right thing to do, at great risk, personal risk and risk to his young family. And he was like Schindler on steroids. And I thought, well, everybody's heard of Schindler, and I was a writer. So I thought, well, I'm going to write the movie.
We're going to get back to that shortly.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Linda Margolin-Royal, and we are talking about her book and why she wrote it, which is called The Star on the Grave. And Linda, you were telling me about Sugihara and your grandparents, yep, and your father and how they were saved by him. Please go on.
Okay, so I started writing a movie. That's sort of where my head went to because I'm an ex-copywriter, advertising copywriter, so I'm used to writing TV commercials, and that's where I felt comfortable. After quite a few years of trying to develop that and getting a grant from Screen Australia and employing a co-writer, quite an experienced guy, COVID hit, and someone said, "You're never going to get a movie up. We don't know if we're ever going to be in a theater again. Why don't you write the book?" So I started writing the book. So that was in about 2020 by then, after years of research and writing. So I cobbled together a semblance of a book and then got a literary editor, and she said, "Oh, this is great. This reads like a well-constructed screenplay."
Wow.
Let's make it look like a book. So we did. Got rejection after rejection. Finally, got a publisher who said, "Yes, love it." Went into the writing and editing phase. About 6 months before October the 7th, I was discussing this with my screenwriter because I was still consulting with him to see if he wanted to use any of the material that I was coming up with in his version of the screenplay while I wrote the book. And he said, and he wasn't Jewish, he was Greek. And he said, "Look, I'm still not understanding what it means to be a Jew." And I said, "Well, let's consult a rabbi." So we did. And after that, he said, No. Look, we all go to our churches and synagogues and temples and we all observe certain rituals, but what is the essence of being a Jew?" And I thought about it. And then I woke up a couple of mornings later, and I said to him, "I've got your answer." And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Okay, what it means to be a Jew is fear of persecution and the desire to not be eradicated from this planet." And he said, "You're crazy. You're mad. I've got Jewish friends, and you're paranoid. Why are you so paranoid?" And I said, "It's not paranoia. I just think that is the essence of being a Jew, the desire to stay alive, to be on this planet. We all pull together, and there is an intense fear of persecution because I think it exists in every or many non-Jews, and it's simmering and festering, and it only takes the right circumstances, like the Holocaust, for it to bubble over and express itself." And he said, "You're so paranoid." Anyway, this was way before October 7. And so I wrote it, and the publisher was fine with it. And I had a character in my novel who was a Holocaust survivor and traumatized and carried trauma, and said to his daughter, "You've got to understand that you can't trust non-Jews, and everyone's out to get us." And then October 7 happened, and my book went to print the week of October 7.
Good heavens. And just for if there's anyone listening in who doesn't know, when we mention October the 7th, it was October the 7th, 2023, when it was the massacre in Israel by genocidal maniacs, Hamas, and some of their proxies. And so that the fact that you were actually writing about Holocaust and people, righteous Gentiles by that stage, you were writing about, and this is when it went to print. It's quite amazing that it did.
Yeah, I think it was. I look at it now thinking it was almost prophetic. It was Beshet, because there's no way post October 7 any publisher would have published my book. It was meant to be, and that message and that theme, and the theme of a righteous Gentile, or two actually, there was a second one, going against the crowd, thinking for themselves, and saving Jews when the rest of the world was, against us. These were messages that I just think were meant to be out there, and so I'm heavily promoting those themes now.
And Linda, I see that I'm reading this from the we're excited to share that Linda Margolin Royal, class of 1980 in Moriah College, has been awarded the Simon Kliteneck Award for Jewish Fiction at the 2025 Australian Jewish Writers Awards with her novel, The Star on the Grave. These awards are run by the Shalom Collective, and it's a cornerstone literary event that celebrates Jewish authors and thinkers from around the country. I mean, this is absolutely amazing that you won that. And tell me about the feedback since then, since it was published.
Yeah, so it was a huge honor to receive this award, any book award, but I mean, it's my debut novel and I was completely overwhelmed. Fantastic to receive it. It's already a bestseller in Australia. It sold 12,000 copies plus whatever audio. And my publisher just distanced themselves quietly from me. Look, they do anyway once you're not a new release anymore. But following that award, and they knew about it a couple of weeks beforehand because they were going to print that on the cover of the reprint, they didn't announce it on social media. They didn't announce that I was a finalist. And when I looked back for the last year, I could see that they were announcing every other author in every other book award. And so I waited 10 days and then I respectfully emailed them saying, you know, I'm just wondering why you haven't announced me on your social media. I can only assume why you haven't, but I'd like to know if there's a reason. Otherwise, if you are intending on announcing it, can you please let me know when so I'll look out for it? And within 1 hour, they didn't respond. He put me, this was the owner, he put me, passed the buck to my editor, who's lovely. And within an hour, there was something up because I think they realized otherwise I was.
And you were not going to keep quiet.
No. Well,
we're going to get back to that shortly.
Yeah, I said it's mutually beneficial. I mean, absolutely. It's sales for you and sales for me, so I can't understand why not. But we all know the subtext, don't we?
Absolutely. And we're going to get back to that shortly.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Linda Margolin-Royal. If you'd like to join in this conversation, please do so on WhatsApp 061-895-1019. We'd love to hear your opinion about what it is to be a righteous Gentile or a righteous person. And, you know, Linda, before we go on, I think both of us have to thank Dr. Les Glassman for putting us in touch with each other. He's a friend of both of ours in Jerusalem and does amazing, amazing podcasts and interviews. And if you'd like to see Linda in person, please go on to one of his YouTubes about her book launch in Israel. It's under Dr. Les Glassman, Linda Margolin Royal. Okay. Linda, we're back with you. So your book was incredibly well received and then suddenly it wasn't. Did they actually not reprint then at that stage in Australia?
Yeah. So what happened was they printed 14,000 copies. They told me after 2 or 3 months, effectively, most of those copies had gone out to retailers, but some could be returned within the year, but I could call myself a bestseller already. And then it just sort of slowed down, which it does. But I was very prolific on social media and the Jewish community in Australia was unbelievably supportive. So I did lots of events. And then a friend of mine who is not Jewish said she had a reprint done already and she'd sold half the amount that I had. And I thought, well, oh. So I asked them if they would do a reprint and they said, no, you've still got about 300 in the warehouse. But I knew that she also still had 300 in the warehouse. So I thought, okay, something's going on. And then it just so happens that a lady in a bookstore in Australia who has to remain anonymous for her own safety, contacted me on Facebook, saw my posts and said, could I please speak to you? So I called her and she said, I've been following your progress for many months and I need to tell you what's going on in our bookstore. I don't know if it's going on in others, but our bookstore predominantly is stocking books on Gaza and Palestinian writers. Your book sold out. It was doing really well. I asked them, could we restock? The owner said no. I asked them, could we get you in for an event to do a book signing and a talk? They said no. And then I felt, and she wasn't Jewish. And she said, I felt so sorry for you, for Israelis and for the Jewish people and the hostage situation. I started wearing a Star of David, and I saw her glaring at my Star of David. And the next day she cut my work hours in half.
Good heavens.
Mm. Yeah. So I wrote about it. And then a lady in New York on LinkedIn, a Jewish lady, messaged me privately and said, you need to do a video of yourself talking about this, bypass the bookstores. This is what we'd do as American Jews, and push. And you tell everyone to go and buy your book, just one copy on Amazon, and let's see if we can get you to the top of Amazon. Within 2 days, I went to number 3 million on Amazon.
Good heavens.
To number one in Jewish literature.
Oh, my gosh.
Amazon USA.
Wow.
Amazon Australia, I went to the top 20 in general fiction and number one in Jewish literature. And so Amazon Australia sold out.
Wow.
And this video was being sent around, people viral. I got messages from South Africa, from Canada, from England, from the USA, from Israel, saying, we've just seen your video. What? Friends had sent to friends and friends on WhatsApp. So the publisher contacted me and said, what's going on? There's a lot of activity and we're getting a lot of orders. Now, I didn't tell them what it was about. I just said, oh, I just did a video promo and people liked it. And then I emailed back and said, how about that reprint now? And they said, oh, no, we're not in a position to do it.
Wow.
I said, what? And then I asked three times. And then Amazon contacted them with the monthly sales figures the next week. And I was one of the top 10 nationally because of that. And so I got this excited email from them saying, oh, we're really delighted to announce we've decided to do a reprint.
Huh. And did they? And did they do
and
a
they,
reprint?
They've just done the reprint.
Okay.
In September. All due to me.
And not keeping quiet, standing up. It takes huge courage. I actually phoned three different bookstores, our main bookstores in South Africa, to find out if they had your book. And the one person said to me, look, I'm going to actually go online to the entire organization around South Africa to see if I can find your book in any store anywhere in South Africa. Well, the message he phoned back, which I was really appreciative of, he phoned back to say, no, it's not in any of our stores at all. And then,
well, so I don't have a South African publishing deal yet. I don't have any international except Israel, where I got my rights. Yeah.
But, I mean, you would think because you had done so incredibly well that they would really get you in and promote you.
Yeah.
So it's pure do you feel it's pure anti-Semitism?
The pushback has been extraordinary. I haven't been able to secure a US publishing deal. I do have a non-Jewish publisher looking at my book at the moment, and I've written a prequel, the backstory, and she's looking at that manuscript as well. But it's been virtually impossible to get a publishing deal anywhere outside of Australia. Israel, I was going to Israel. I've just come back for a wedding, and I thought, oh, well, I'll launch it myself over there. So I asked them for the rights because they own all the rights worldwide, my publisher. But they were quite happy to give me Israel. So I got the rights back, and I self-published and did a book launch in Jerusalem, and it's available in Pomerantz bookstore in Jerusalem, and he's going to distribute for me at the moment. I'm still trying to get an Israeli publisher on board with that, but they've been through such hell that, you know, it's pretty tough over there. If there's any South African publishers listening, I'm open to to a deal and offering it through my agent or through, you know, to the publisher to see if we can get there.
I'm going to send you someone's name after our program who is in publishing in Israel.
Wonderful.
In Israel.
Oh, now, fantastic.
Now, going back to your grandfather, I would like to you to tell us a little bit about Sugihara, and you also mentioned Jan van. What was his surname? I can't remember.
Jan is a mouthful. Jan Zwartendijk.
Wartendach. Okay, yeah. Because, I mean, those are true righteous Gentiles that need to always be remembered. So would you like to tell us a bit about them? But just before we go to that, remember, anyone who would like to send us a message, please do so on 061-895-1019. Okay, back to you, Linda.
Okay, so what happened was Jewish refugees started fleeing Poland across the border to Lithuania because, as you know, being South African, there were a hell of a lot of Lithuanian Jews. You guys seem to manage to get out in the teens and 20s and escape the Holocaust. So I know there's not many survivors or very few. But a lot of Lithuanian Jews went and settled in Poland, and they are the parents and grandparents of a lot of Australians. So they came here after the Holocaust. They fled to their grandparents and great-grandparents in Lithuania to try and get away from Poland. Mine happened to get across in December 1939. It's quite a hair-raising adventure. I've written it in the book. And I don't know how they got out, but they did. It was my father, who was then 11, and my grandparents. And then they found out that two Dutch Jews who were studying in Lithuania couldn't go back to the Netherlands because the Nazis had invaded. And they went to the Dutch consul, Jan Zwartendijk. They asked him for papers to a Dutch colony near the US because nobody could get to the USA, called Curaçao. He issued them papers. And then, of course, within hours, the news got out in the community. And he had said, but you need to transit through Japan to get there. So you need to go down the road to the Japanese consul, Chiyuni Sugihara, for a transit visa. They managed to get those visas. And then both consulates were inundated with thousands of refugees who were desperate to get out. And these two gentlemen, even though those were all, the rest of them were Polish, not Dutch Jews, Zwartendijk issued them papers. And then Sugihara issued them transit visas to Japan, even though Japan was an ally of Nazi Germany, and he asked three times permission. Three times it came back, you're not to issue visas to these Jewish refugees, and he went against that.
Huh. A message came through from Barbara Klug saying, is your book available in South Africa? And no, it's not available. I have checked with all the different bookstores.
Hopefully, Amazon.
And go through Amazon and get it there. And if it's showing you that it's not available right now, it will be later on this month because it has gone into reprint. Now, Linda, if your father were alive today, would he be shocked that this is happening again, this anti-Semitism and
horrified. Yes. I mean, we have the largest population of Holocaust survivors outside of Israel in Australia. Everyone whose parents are still alive are suffering terrible trauma, those parents reliving it. And everyone whose parents have passed away, like mine, we're all saying, thank God they're not alive to see it. They would never. They all picked Australia because it was the, I mean, my husband, unfortunately, his father went through Auschwitz and survived, but then suicided when my husband was 16. He had terrible depression. And he said the reason why he chose Australia was because there were no wars. It was the furthest point possible away from Europe. So they all thought it was a safe haven. Never in my life have I ever seen anything like this. But it's poor leadership. It has really fueled it.
It appears to be so. But I must admit, you're certainly getting enough people there and around the world who are prepared to follow that poor leadership. When you first saw what was happening at the Opera House in Sydney with the pro-Palestinian group, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, what were your feelings then?
We were horrified that the police were so scared that we were going to incite violence from the other side. We were told to stay away from the Opera House at all cost. So we couldn't even, we felt unsupported and rejected, and that we didn't have a voice. And so we could see from very early on they were going to pander to the other side because they were scared of violence. They knew they were violent and we were passive and peace-loving. And they don't look, the problem is they're anglicized, they're not Middle Eastern, and so they don't understand the Middle Eastern mentality. Mm. So they shy away from it. They just want to keep the peace at all costs. Mm. So we were horrified. I mean, when you hear people screaming on the steps of the Opera House, gas the Jews, fuck the Jews, and then it comes out in the paper the next day, oh, no, they didn't really say that. We re-listened to the recording and they were actually saying, where are the Jews?
Mm.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it's we were just...
Absolutely. This is a family radio, so don't swear again, please.
Sorry. We're a little more relaxed in Australia.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
South Africa is very conservative still. You know, something okay. Albert Einstein said is, the world will not be destroyed by those who do evil, but by those who watch them without doing anything. And I think that is what we're seeing. And that's where the disappointment has come in to so many of us. People who we have thought would stand with us are actually not doing so. And as we're talking about Sydney and you're not going, not you being advised not to go to the Opera House to protest, I was thinking about Reverend Mark Leach, who's been on my program a few times, who unfurled his, he was on the steps of the cathedral and he unfurled his flag, his Israeli flag from his backpack. And he was chased until he had to hide behind some police cars. But that took huge courage. So right now, I do see that I saw in Bondi, for instance, you had a peaceful protest. The other side were not as peaceful. What do you feel, is there going to be a change happening in Australia that you can see, or do you feel that it needs a lot more people to speak out?
The problem is there's a beautiful but silent majority, and there is a very noisy, woke bunch of we call useful idiots who don't know the geopolitics of the region. They have no idea what they are protesting for. It's cool. It's in trend. Now that the war is over and they're still trying to organise rallies, we're all wondering why are they being permitted to even apply? What are they protesting about? It's over. Well, it's not over by a long shot, but it's certainly calmed down. I think it will calm down, but it will calm down to a new level, a new normal. It's gone up and it will plateau now. I don't think it'll ever fully go back down. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people have shown their true colours, that they are latent anti-Semites. And it is... in many people, way more than we ever expected worldwide. Anti-Semitism has climbed by 700% just in Australia alone. But there's a big silent majority, and I meet many lovely, respectful non-Jews and get lots of messages from people saying, don't worry, we're on your side.
So going back to Sugihara, who saved your grandparents, what do you think it was about him that enabled him to step up? Do you think it was an inherent love of humanity, or what was it?
So he was a really interesting character, and you can read about him in my book, whoever wants to buy it. His true story is weaved through in a parallel narrative in the book. But essentially he had a very strong moral compass. He was a unique individual, and you can see that because he was Japanese, and Japanese normally toe the line and are very obedient, but he was very disobedient. His father wanted him to study medicine, and the story goes, because I'm very well connected with his only surviving son, Nobuki, and I deferred back to him for all information. I didn't rely on anything I read or saw on the internet until I'd got it past him. His father wanted him to study medicine, and he didn't want to. He wanted to join the diplomatic corps. So he went in, left the paper blank, the entrance exam, and he walked out. And he went off at 18, and he went to, I think it was, where did he go? Harbin, maybe. And he went to study, And then he got put in charge of the Manchurian Railway project in the early 30s and rose to the top very quickly, very high ranking official. And he saw brutality of the Japanese against the Chinese population. And he said he wouldn't abide by it, and he quit.
Good heavens.
So that was just the way he was.
Are we going to talk about him a bit more shortly?
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. And I am back with Linda Margolin-Royal. Our time is going very quickly. Linda is telling us a bit about Sugihara, who was the person who saved her grandparents from the Holocaust, during the Holocaust. And he was a Japanese diplomat posted to Lithuania. And you were saying that he saw the Japanese treatment of the Chinese, and that even that affected him. Is that right? We left
yes.
there.
Yes, he couldn't abide by that, so he quit his position, which was a very high position. So he was a risk taker. So he generally, I guess, was someone that saw wrongdoing and followed an extremely strong moral compass, whether it was, I think his family might have been samurai, and, you know, they followed a code of ethics, a lot of the Japanese, the Bushido code, which, you know, you can look up and see that they just follow a very moral code of conduct. And I guess he was just one of those individuals.
And I see that he was fluent in Russian, and that's what the Japanese sent him to the Lithuanian capital, Kovno, in 1939. And so your grandparents, when they were granted the visas, they were one of about 1,800 visas that were issued by Sugihara.
Exactly, 2,139 legal ones that we know of. There were many others that were forged, apparently. People got through in other ways. But 2,139 on Sugihara's list of visa recipients. My family are numbers 745 and 746. My father was attached to my grandmother's. So a lot of these visas covered more than one individual, which is why 6,000 were saved.
Good heavens. And he was named righteous among the nations at Yad Vashem, in Jerusalem.
Yes.
Now, you say that you met his son. And just tell me a bit about his son, because I must admit, I don't know if anything is really known about the son.
Ah, he's amazing. So what happened was he was 18. So his father couldn't find meaningful work because he was quietly dismissed from the diplomatic corps on his return. He was in a prisoner of war camp with his sons until 1947 in Bucharest. He returned in 1947 to Japan, couldn't find meaningful work, eventually found work in Moscow because he was fluent in Russian, working for a petroleum company or something, I think, and only went back to visit the family once a year for a week.
Good heavens.
That's the only time he says he saw his father. Said he was a very loving father, but he didn't get much time with him. When he was discovered by one of the survivors, who was the Israeli attaché to Tokyo, a guy called Yehoshua Nishri, found him in Moscow in 1968, which is when my book is set, because I decided to create a fictional story of a reunion of Sugihara survivors going back to Japan, to Kobe, to try and find and thank Sugihara once he'd been found. He recalls that when his father was found, he had no idea that he'd saved all these people because it was 1940 and he had no idea the fate of them. He thought maybe he'd saved one or two, he said.
Good heavens.
So he was completely overwhelmed. And the Israeli government wanted to thank him. And he said, look, I've been able to put two sons through college, but my youngest, Nabuki, is 18 and I can't afford to send him to college. And they said, well, we'll give him a scholarship to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. So 3 weeks later, Nabuki says he was off on a plane to Jerusalem. He studied there. He learned his trade from the religious Jews and became a diamond merchant and lives in Belgium now. He lived in Jerusalem for 10 years. He's fluent in Hebrew and he calls Israel his homeland.
Good heavens, is that so? Yeah. What a story. Isn't that amazing? It's amazing. And yeah. How did you go about meeting him? Did you contact him?
Yeah, my brother lives in Zurich and somehow crossed paths with someone that knew him because he was in Belgium, managed to get his email address. I emailed him and said, I'm writing the story of your father. Can I interview you? And he said, this was in 2019. And he said, I'm going to be at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York in May, giving an address. I'm being interviewed by a journalist there. So I said, okay, I'm getting on a plane. I'm coming over. And so I went and interviewed a few very prominent Sugihara survivors who live in America. And I went there and there were 300 of us survivors and descendants in the audience.
Wow.
And we all got together, took a group photo, and it was just amazing. I asked him if I could hug him, and his wife is Belgian, and you know, I could see he was a bit reserved being Japanese. And she said, oh, no, it's fine. Go on. I said to him, I'm sorry, but you're the closest thing to hugging the man to whom I owe my life.
Absolutely. And with the other, so that's fascinating that you met so many other children of people that you had saved. Did you all discuss the different experiences with your parents? Or
yes.
Because that's a book on its own, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a very common thread. And so in my research, I discovered that they also, a lot of them, didn't find out until their 40s or 50s that they were descendants of Sugihara visa recipients, because people just didn't talk about it, because I think they just compartmentalized it all and wanted to get on with life.
Gosh, that must have been very interesting meeting them. I mean, that's, as I say, that's a story on its own that perhaps you should write. But you're also looking at doing a film.
Yeah,
will it be a film on the star, on the grave, or will it be called something else?
It won't be called The Star on the Grave. It'll have a more movie title, a movie appropriate title. It'll either be a movie or a TV series. I have a producer in LA that I've had all the way along. We're working together. We're looking more at a TV series, a limited series. I think it will do better. Something like The Tattooist of Auschwitz, if anyone's seen it, it's
absolutely
fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very exciting. So right now, are you doing a lot of interviews? What are you doing in this time?
A lot of interviews. The TEDx Youth Talk is supposed to be going up this week. I actually recorded it 4 months ago. For TEDx Youth in Sydney. It's become more than just the book. It's become, you know, trying to make people understand that, like these righteous Gentiles, you know, there are a lot of them, like you said, Mark Leach, there's a lady called Erin Molan, there's an Aboriginal lady, Nova Paris, there's another good friend of mine, Colonel Michael Scott. They're all amazing Gentiles that are standing up for us. And I say to them all, you're all righteous among the nations. You don't have to issue transit visas to be regarded as righteous. You don't have any skin in the game. You're all taking risk and you're standing up for us, and we're all incredibly grateful. So I've been trying to sort of spread the word and trying to get other non-Jews to sort of have a really good think about themselves and what they would do in these situations, and maybe not follow the biased media.
We'll get back to that.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Linda Margolin Royal. And our time is going very quickly. You were talking about people who are already stepping out and becoming righteous Gentiles. I think of Douglas Murray, and in our country, we have a very large Christian group who are very pro-Israel. And very interestingly enough, Mandela's granddaughters were very moved by a visit to Israel. And if anyone would like to read this report about them and how horrified they were and how surprised they were that there was a two stories that people killed simply for being, people were killed simply for being Jewish on the 7th of October. If you would like to read the article, please go have a look on Safari or Google under Jewish Report, and you'll see it's Mandela's granddaughters moved by the visit to Israel. I found that very moving, actually. And then, of course, there's Colonel Richard Kemp. And you've got the colonel, as you say, that you talk to there. And we need to promote these voices as well, because they are standing out against a lot of backlash. There's a German woman, someone sent this to me, I think it might have been on LinkedIn. Her name was Caroline Preisler, and I'm mentioning her. It says, a German lawyer and politician, and she has stood as one of the bravest voices for Israel since October the 7th. While others stayed silent, she stood alone in the middle of pro-Hamas protests, holding signs demanding the release of kidnapped hostages and their photos. She was attacked, harassed, and threatened, but she never backed down. She didn't do this because she was Jewish. She's not. She did it because she believes in truth, in humanity, and in the moral duty to stand up against anti-Semitism and terror. If you'd like to read up about her, if anyone heard, it's Caroline, Caroline, Preisler, Preisler. She's certainly a name that needs to be mentioned. Now back to you again, Linda. How, if people would like to contact you, what is the best way to contact you?
I have a website, staronthegrave.com, all one word, lowercase. They can see my details there. There should be links to my LinkedIn profile, my Facebook profile, and my email. If they want to contact you privately, I can give them my WhatsApp details as well.
Okay, because I think you will be getting, I will certainly be getting messages. And it's been fantastic talking to you today. How would you like, what would you like to end this program with? What would you like to say? What message?
Gosh. Look, I just think we need to all follow our instincts. We need to be brave. We need to speak out. People have been saying to me, you know, you're so brave. Well, if we speak out, then we will thwart this. If we stay silent, well, that's what happened in the Holocaust. Everyone stayed silent. Mm. It takes courage to speak out, and you have to do it respectfully, and you have to make the other side, if you're getting pushback, understand that we are human and we do have emotions and we do feel for the other side. There were terrible casualties. It's just that they were as a result of a war that we didn't start. And we are not brutal terrorists that indiscriminately massacre. If people were killed, we are remorseful that there were casualties on both sides. And I think if you make people aware and you speak to one person at a time and gently educate, you can't blanket educate, you can't scream at people. And they don't want to know statistics, and they don't want to see visuals of rapes and burns and murders. They don't want to know about it because they have their agenda. But you just have to try and gently educate.
I think that is it's something that all of us are needing to take on at the moment. We cannot remain silent any longer. And as the war is not abating by the sounds of it, the remaining dead hostages, their bodies have not been returned to Israel. My heart absolutely breaks for all those hostage families waiting desperately to be able to bury their loved ones. It's just too terrible. It's almost as though Israel is being held to ransom at the moment by that. And because they know how much we care about our living and our dead, wherever we are in the world, we do care. And certainly when I personally see photos coming out of Gaza and I see the children, my heart aches. But let's not remain silent. And as Martin Luther King Jr. said, in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. So please, whoever is listening in today, realize you have a voice and it can be a voice for peace. Thank you, Linda, so much for being on my program. Thank you, Craig. Thank you, Vusi. And thank you, Peterson.